Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Next on News One Now, a major desegregation case in the issue in Maryland. Will they fund HBCUs? So we'll talk with Kristen Clark, the Lawyers Committee, about this important trial taking place in Maryland that frankly mainstream media has told you nothing about. Also, the woman at the center of Bill Cosby's sexual assault trial breaks her silence and takes the stand. We'll have more Andrea Constan's testimony and a live report from a Philadelphia reporter who is covering the trial. Trump wants to pour more than $1 billion federal dollars into school voucher programs, but some education advocates are fighting that plan. We will talk with Randy Weingarten right here, the Federation of American Teachers, and also charter school founder Dr. Steve Perry. He'll debate this very issue. A Las Vegas police officer is charged with involuntary manslaughter after a coroner's report concludes the unarmed black man he was chasing died of asphyxiation from an unauthorized chokehold. We'll talk with the attorney of the victim's family. Also, we'll speak with the only black governor in the United States, Governor Kenneth Mapp of the U.S. Virgin Islands, about how his administration is able to maintain one of the highest minimum wages while also expanding Medicaid. It's time to bring the funk on News One Now on TV One. In Baltimore, closing arguments begin in a lawsuit over a long-time segregation in the state's university system. The plaintiffs argue that programs at well-funded, traditionally white public universities siphon off students from historically black colleges and universities. The suit, folks, was filed 11 years ago. That's after the Maryland Higher Education Commission approved a joint MBA program between Towson University and the University of Baltimore, which Morgan State complained hurt its own MBA program. The plaintiffs, including students and alumni of some of Maryland's HBCUs, including Morgan State, Bowie State, and Coppin State, want Maryland to stop allowing traditionally white schools to duplicate programs at the HBCUs. The development of unique programs at the HBCUs and funds for needed capital improvements. The federal judge hearing the case wrote in a 2013 opinion that Maryland has had a, quote, shameful history of segregation for much of the past century, and that public higher education opportunities for African Americans either didn't exist or were decidedly inferior to those available to white citizens in Maryland. The plaintiff's legal team has proposed that about 100 programs be transferred to or started at the HBCUs, including moving a Homeland Security program currently at Towson to Coppin. Joining us now here in D.C. is Kristen Clark, President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights Under Law. They are representing the plaintiffs. Also, folks, understand, we reached out to the Maryland Higher Education Commission, the defendant in the case, but got no response. Also on our panel today, Dr. Greg Carr, Chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, Dr. Chris Metzler, a legal scholar and political scientist who is CEO of the JMI Group, and Spencer Overton, President of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. Kristen, again, this is one of those lawsuits not getting lots of attention, not much focus in terms of mainstream media, but it's symptomatic of the problem of HBCUs across the country, where they were created, underfunded from day one, and then duplicate programs where they say, no, look, you don't want to go there, but you can go to the other traditionally white school.
What's remarkable about this case, Roland, is you have the Supreme Court issues a ruling, Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, that says you have to desegregate. And in the 1970s, we saw the state of Maryland actually make some progress. HBCUs in the state of Maryland were more racially diverse in the 1970s than they are today. And that's because the state of Maryland has undercut every effort, every attempt that HBCUs have made in Maryland to attract racially diverse student bodies. They would create unique programs that were not offered at any of the traditionally white institutions in Maryland. Unique programs in the sciences and in the technology fields. Masters and teaching programs that were not being offered. And the moment that they created these programs and saw white students starting to apply to these schools, Maryland would swoop in and give money to the traditionally white institutions to set up competitor programs doomed.
And the way this is supposed to work is this. I mean, I dealt with this in Texas, with the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board. They want students deciding where they go to college, not based upon I like the university, but based upon the major. And so they also, again, supposed to, what you don't want when it comes to state dollars, saying, wait a minute, we're spending money over here and money over here for the exact same program, exactly, which is actually a waste of taxpayer dollars. What they really want is to say, no, if you want to major in that, you go to that school, regardless of what kind of school it is.
Exactly, and that's what happened in the 70s and isn't happening today. So this is one of the most important desegregation cases in the higher ed context in decades. And what we hope is that the judge, what we won in 2013, and we're now concluding a long trial over the remedy. And what we want is a robust remedy that will require Maryland to fund HBCUs at a level that will allow them to thrive. And most importantly, stop giving money to traditionally white institutions, allowing them to compete and take away the ability of HBCUs to thrive and attract racially diverse student bodies in Maryland.
Mississippi had a similar lawsuit. Dr. Alvin Chambers was a lead attorney for that, that also changed universities there. How does this compare to that suit, or even what they're talking about in North Carolina, in Texas, and some other states as well?
Mm-hmm. The judge in our case said that the level of segregation in Maryland rivals what we saw in Mississippi in the case that you just referenced. I mean, this is one of the most racially segregated systems in the country today. And Maryland is, through their actions, has allowed this to happen, has allowed the state to turn the clock back and now be in a worse position than they were in the 1970s.
Okay, so here's what's interesting. So the state, they say they have a $26 million remediation program that will address these problems.
Anemic.
26 million?
It's anemic. It's all anemic. They offered to create a summer program to help educate students about HBCUs. We want real relief. We want real funding that will allow the HBCUs in Maryland to get back on their feet and be able to compete with the other schools and attract racially diverse student bodies again.
Great, Carl. I want to pull you in here again. This is a case that you're not going to see talked about.
No.
Anywhere else because that impacts our community directly.
That's right, Roland. That's what sent me to law school. I'm a proud graduate of Tennessee State. They were under the Guyer case. In the first time in American history where a historically black college took over a historically white one, when the University of Tennessee built a whole new white campus in downtown Nashville rather than comply with the litigation. You know, Attorney Clark, do you have any hope that they're not just going to continue to go rogue? Because this accounting thing with Towson, this was just a slap in the face. Is there a 14th Amendment or not?
Well, we've been fighting them for decades, and we'll fight till the bitter end.
Yes.
We know that, you know, we're mounting this case at a moment where we're seeing this administration disrespect HBCUs at every turn. Betsy DeVos, President, none of them seem to appreciate the historical value and significance of HBCUs today. So we will fight till the bitter end.
Spencer, I make the point all the time. If you come to D.C. and if you go to the White House,
right,
you look at the White House on the right, you look, there's only one federal agency that shares along with the White House, Department of Treasury.
Treasury.
Power, right, money, yep, power. And basically suffocating HBCUs by not funding them has been a way that white supremacy has been able to be maintained. And then, of course, folks say, oh, no, but everybody is equal when it comes to education. But when you're unwilling to spend those dollars, that proves in terms of what your intent is when it comes to educating black kids and others.
Yeah, it's about the money. We got to follow the money in terms of funding our institutions. I really just admire and appreciate Kristen in terms of her great leadership in terms of moving this forward and the Lawyers Committee generally.
Chris, real quick.
Yeah, you. I know you were joking about that remedy, right?
but we're dead serious.
I mean, I have
to
never
educate them about HBCUs.
Oh, that's using that. Oh, that's it,
fine,
man. No, that's
look,
it.
Look, look. Increase,
that's ridiculous.
Increase awareness.
Yeah. In fact, let me help you out here. A $26 million remediation program. Hold up. But they've spent more than $2 million defending the case. So 10% of the remediation program, they spent on legal fees.
Right. And to go sit in Tennessee, they said they're going to set aside 75 seats at law schools, which they never even gave that up.
And just quick note, 30% of Maryland is black, right? It's one of the blackest states in the country in terms of, I mean, why does this happen in Maryland?
Actually, it's the outside of Mississippi. I believe it's the second, the third largest concentration of African Americans in the state. Yeah. Kristen?
HBCUs are incredibly important institutions. They are worthy of being defended. And we hope that, we're confident that we're going to prevail here in hammering out a real remedy to get HBCUs back on their feet and on equal footing with TWIs, traditionally white institutions in the state, and that will provide a roadmap for the rest of the country to help ensure the future longevity and success of HBCUs across our nation.
All right, Kristen, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot. And again, to folks, this is why this show matters, because you're not going to see the other networks cover this story. They're focused right now on Comey and Russia and Trump every single day. That's why it matters. Also, as you know, I started the initiative hashtag HBCU Giving Day. So today I'm wearing Florida A&M's lapel pin. And so what I'll do is I'll be actually tweeting out their link for you to also give and support our institutions. We can't just expect states to fund them or private corporations. We must also support them, especially graduates out there as well. And so I have that for you just a little bit later on social media. Let's go to what's happening in Pennsylvania, where the Bill Cosby trial is in its second day. The woman at the center of all of this, Andrea Constant, took the stand where she talked about the comedian allegedly drugging and assaulting her. She told the jury she got to know Bill Cosby while working at Temple University, where he was a trustee. She gave graphic details about the night of the alleged attack 13 years ago and said she felt humiliated and confused. Let's go to Vincent Thompson, a reporter from WURD Radio, who's been covering this. Vincent, tell us about what else took place yesterday in this trial happening in Norristown, Pennsylvania.
Well, we finally got to see the star witness in this case, 44-year-old Canadian-born Constand. She was a surprise witness. We knew that she would testify. We just didn't know when she would testify. It was so surprising that even the judge later said, I didn't know that she was going to testify. Guys, you got to let me know when major witnesses are testifying.
Hold on. So the prosecution dropped her on day two and the judge didn't even know?
Judge didn't even know. Judge admonished the prosecution.
That's not smart for the prosecution.
Yeah, it was incredible. That's why it was one of the things I wanted to mention. In a trial that's taken 18 months to get where we are, a bunch of witnesses that we know are going to come, the prosecution never let the judge know. And the judge didn't know that she was going to testify until she sat down in the chair.
And that's why
Judge Stephen O'Neill was livid with the prosecution. He allowed her to testify. She testified for about 3 hours, but she stopped at 5:30 p.m. Eastern time, and she's going to have to continue today. But the judge really lit into the district attorney and the prosecution side, saying, "Gotta let me know about these things."
Vincent, what was Bill Cosby? Were you able to see Bill Cosby, his reaction while she testified? I saw some other reports that said that he was scowling at her. What did you see?
Well, I was about five rows away in the court, and what I saw was Cosby did not look directly at Ms. Constant at all. He didn't make any eye contact with her. If he would look around, he would look at his attorneys, or he would look toward the actual jury, the 12 members of the jury and the six alternates in the jury. But he didn't make direct eye contact with Ms. Constant at all. But she was a very solid witness. She broke at times, cried at times when describing what happened to her allegedly, but she's remained calm during the hours of testimony. Another thing that's been interesting, and we talked about it yesterday, the optics. The prosecution had their female attorney do all the questioning of Ms. Constant.
The black female attorney?
The black female attorney. The black female attorney, Federin, and for the Cosby trial, for the Cosby defensive team, it was the female, Ms. Agursa, who actually did the cross-examination of Ms. Constant. And I expect Ms. Agursa will also do the cross-examination today. She's going to be on the seat. Constant's going to be on the seat for a while. They're going to light into her, Rowling, because they got to make her not seem credible.
She finished yesterday at 5:30. She's going to return to the stand today to continue testifying for the prosecution or cross-examination by the defense.
The cross-examination by the defense.
Got it. All right, folks, Vincent Thompson with WURD Radio in Philadelphia. Vincent's going to be providing us just his daily reports. He is there covering this trial in the courtroom, and that's why we want to have his perspective. And also for folks out there, WURD is a black-owned radio station there in Philadelphia. Vincent, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Roland. Speak to you again tomorrow.
All right, then, folks, coming up next, big debate between Randy Weingarten and Dr. Steve Perry on the issue of vouchers and their impact. Will they make a difference for African Americans? This was our simulcast on the Tom Jones Morning Show. Next, News 19 TV 1.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Presenting.
Roland.
From Washington, D.C., Roland Martin. Good morning.
Tom, Sybil, Bill Bellamy, how we doing?
Good. Man, we are doing fantastic, sir.
All right, then. Well, first of all, it's going to be a huge day tomorrow in D.C. You've got Jim Comey testifying about Trump and Russia. Oh, it's going to be FIFA in the Funkhouse on Capitol Hill. Of course, all of the networks are going to be covering that. And so we look forward to that. We'll be talking about that on Monday. But I got to give a shout out before we do our discussion today, Tom. On Saturday, I'm in Houston, and my parents, Reginald and Imelda Martin, will be celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary.
Aww.
So I want to give them a shout out. And so we've got a great day planned for them. And so it's going to be some big surprises. So I wanted to give them a shout out. 50 years of marriage. That does not happen a lot these days. So I wanted to go ahead and do that. All right, folks. So let's get right to it. The debate over school vouchers is heating up again with President Donald Trump proposing to pour some $1.4 billion into expanding school voucher programs nationwide. The proposal has prompted some in the education community to push back. Opponents say the president's plan will not help the majority of American school children and will be a terrible blow to the nation's public schools. Of course, vouchers have been gaining steam since the 1990s. 13 states in District of Columbia currently have school voucher programs. Joining us right now, talk about this issue from Hartford, Connecticut, Dr. Steve Perry, founder and head of Capital Preparatory Schools. Steve, you there?
I am, sir.
All right. Also in studio with me, Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. Randy, I want to start with you.
Okay.
You recently did an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times talking about this.
Congratulations to your parents.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Opposing this particular program, why?
Number one, the new studies about vouchers say that they don't work for children. Number two, and I think, frankly, this is as important, is what was being cut. If you look at what happened in Michigan with all the cuts to schools, reading scores in Michigan, where Betsy DeVos was very instrumental in those cuts, went from basically 28 in reading in 2003 28 to 41st in reading in 2015. There's $11 billion of cuts. So the things that actually support kids in public schools are being cut at the same time as there's a promotion of a strategy that the recent studies are showing don't work. Now, as Steve knows, you know, and some of my members are really upset with me for this, I believe in school, in every public school being a place where parents want to send their children, where educators want to teach. I believe that there is a role for charters. But we have to ensure that the neighborhood public school is viable and that money doesn't get stripped for after-school programs, for mental mm-hmm. health programs, for reading programs, and for all that. That is the real problem with her budget.
Steve.
Randy has supported educational apartheid for much of her career. She's focused on making sure that African-American children stay in some of the lowest performing school systems because, in fact, she, through her organization, which acts in many ways like a cartel, has access to these teachers' salaries
through union dues.
One of the important things to keep in mind is that the black community has for a long time been fighting against these systems that have created this system, like housing covenants and redlining and other things that have made black children go to some of the poorest performing schools in America. So finally, African Americans are getting the way out. We've fought our way out. Many mothers and grandmothers and aunts right now are waking their children up and putting them on buses and trains to get them to community schools and other communities, because in their communities, they don't have an honest choice. So what we've seen is there have been over 19 studies, in fact, that have shown that vouchers, that have studied vouchers, and of the 19, 14 have found that they, in fact, work. We think of vouchers in our community differently. We think of them as like a scholarship that you might get to St. Mary's or Notre Dame, because the school that's in your neighborhood, in fact, isn't working. So African Americans overwhelmingly support school choice, support vouchers. Latinos, the only folks who don't, quite frankly, are wealthy and white people.
Now, Randy, I want to go back to you on this. And so here's what's interesting. We did a study last year. Mm-hmm. Cornell Belcher's firm, Brilliant Corners, commissioned them. More than 70% of African-American parents with kids in school supported charter schools.
Right.
More than 70% of those same black parents supported school vouchers. And so to Steve's point, that is sort of how African-Americans look at it, because what I hear from black parents is like, look, I don't care. They're saying, I'm just tired of my kid not getting a good education. If there is another way, fine, I'll take it.
And so when in that study, and you and I have talked about that study, when things get pit about, do you want to take money from the neighborhood public school for the voucher school, people say no. And frankly, what many people have seen, Steve is absolutely wrong about all the new studies. When you see in Indiana and Louisiana and the study that just happened in D.C., parents want a safe school for their kids and they want joy for their kids. And we have to do that. But you ask parents head to head, do you want a neighborhood public school that's going to help your kids? And you want to make sure that that's a good school? Overwhelmingly, black, white, Latino will say yes. And what has happened with the recent voucher schools is it's increased segregation, it's increased discrimination. And so the goal here is we have to actually help parents have what they need for their kids. And the other goal is, and just as a point of personal privilege, you know, I taught school in Clara Barton High School in Brooklyn, New York. Mm-hmm. I only taught black and brown kids. My kids made it to national competitions. I'm tired of somebody making a claim against teachers, many of whom are black and brown, who want to actually help kids. Don't call, you know, teacher unions that.
Steve.
Well, the facts are the facts. The facts are that African Americans are attending some of the lowest performing schools in America that are traditional schools. Finally, African Americans are making their way out to successful charter schools, which Randy has fought hard against and lobbied against when those schools do not pay into the cartel of the teachers union. So this is the fact. This is the fact also is that we as African Americans, and I find it disingenuous for anyone to get on black media and trying to convince black people, most of whom, even the people who work at TV One, are exercising school choice. So I find it disingenuous for Randy Weingarten, attorney Randy Weingarten, to consistently try to present herself as someone who has our interests at heart. We've seen this story before, and it's time to move on.
All right, folks. I want to thank both of you for joining us. First of all, we had part one of this debate with the Tom Joyner Morning Show. Tom, Sybil, and Bill will continue part two on TV One. But thanks a bunch to Randy and Steve for being on the Tom Joyner Morning Show.
Somebody's my pleasure.
Gonna have to stay after school after this conversation.
Yeah.
Fire.
Yeah. Hugging next.
All right, folks. Thanks a bunch. We're gonna go to break right here for TV One, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation between Randy Weingarten, Dr. Steve Perry, and bringing our panel as well. Next, News One Now on TV One.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
All right, folks, we're continuing our conversation regarding pros and cons of the issue of school vouchers. Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, Dr. Steve Perry, founder and head of Capital Preparatory Schools. And so, Randy, I want to go back. So you made a comment during the break,
right.
that I want you to go ahead and repeat again. Go ahead.
So, you know, I find that the kind of conversation when one actually starts just insulting others. What the unions have done in this country has been to help increase equality. The unions created middle class. What teacher unions do is they fight for kids when kids don't have a voice. And ultimately, you're all right. We have to make sure when half the kids that go to public schools are poor, we have to make sure that it is the great equalizer. But you can't keep taking a baseball bat to schools and keep telling them, change, 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 change. The schools that actually work have had, you know, focus on well-being, powerful instruction, teaching teachers how to teach, including dealing with classroom management and cultures of collaboration so that community comes in and you invest in that. And my point is, regardless of where you stand on the voucher debate, and I think that if it was really working, you'd have a whole lot more kids in voucher schools. We've had vouchers and charters for 25 years. There's less than 0.5% of kids that are in voucher schools. But don't kill the federal dollar for education. Don't kill all after-school programs. Don't kill all community school programs. Don't kill all training. And don't take $1 billion out of Title I.
So I'm going to ask you this question, then I'm going to go to Steve. So let's say they didn't kill those programs and still want to expand school vouchers. Would you still oppose it?
Personally, I would probably still oppose it.
Okay.
Wait. But what I'm saying is my institution has not opposed charters. And what we've seen is because I believe, and the reason why is I'm a religious Jew. I believe in the First Amendment. I believe in the separation of church and state. And that reason, I would still probably personally oppose it. But on charters, when you look at the for-profit charters and the virtual charters, it's the same situation.
Okay, Steve.
You know, what's cool about having a conversation with Randy Weingarten is part of it is that the truth becomes a quick casualty. Her organization has vehemently fought against school choice and continues to do so. We operate charter schools now in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and in New York. She fights them vehemently. She knows that. So it doesn't matter that the truth is a casualty for her. She's just going to make a point. The fact is that parents deserve the right to choose. My child, my choice is a right. And how dare she, a person who gets to live in a tawny suburb, get to tell people who are living in squalor in these here United States that they have to go to failed schools because those failed schools pay dues up to the organization that she heads. We have to fight for our children, and parents are doing it. It's the reason why we opened a school in Harlem and 1,500 children applied for 80 seats. It's the reason why we opened a school in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and 1,000 children applied for 250 seats, and over and over and over again. It's because the community wants out. There would be more voucher programs if, in fact, there wasn't so much misinformation spread by the cartel that is the teachers union. We know that as a fact that we are fighting one organization and one organization only. It's not parents. Parents every single day, whether they be wealthy or poor, whether they be black or white, are making the choice to send their children to the very best school that they have access to. So I support the parents. I believe that parents, more than I, know what's best for their children. Public education is not defined by the product, meaning the building at the end of the street. It's defined by the process, meaning the people who were educated. And so when the public, the parents, say they want to choose another school, how dare anyone, any special interest group, try to convince us that we need to go back to an older America.
I want to pull
we
in.
We need to go forward.
I want to pull in
and
Greg,
make sure.
Mm-hmm. I want to put in Greg Carr here. Howard University is the only HBCU in America with a charter school.
Yes.
Tied to it. I've made perfectly clear why I stand on school choice. I'm in support of it. I went to magnet schools. Now, here's what I found to be very interesting. I've had these debates with the folks who there have been critics of magnet schools.
Of course.
Who have said segregated, exclusionary, because you get to apply to actually get in. What's interesting to me is that when we talk about this idea of having different modes of education, even some of those other ones were still fought. So on this issue, your thoughts about it in terms of where we are, where we should be going.
What you said was important in the first segment, Roland. Black parents don't care. I think it's disingenuous to stigmatize people. Oh, they're living in these. It sounds like Trump. You're living in hell. What do you have to lose? No, 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 no. What Du Bois said 60 years ago was true. What black people don't care about, they don't care about segregated or integrated education. What we want is education. The teachers' unions are unions. The unions must be supported, but they must also be reformed. There's been a lot of racism in unions. Right. Teachers' unions are not excluded. But this whole idea that charter schools or vouchers are better has been disproven by the evidence. Steve is exactly wrong. And I am a teacher. I'm a public school graduate, and I teach at the best private black university in the country, and I'm here to tell you, one with a private school, with a charter school, if you have quality teachers in the classroom, then learning will occur. And what this country has to decide is whether or not it's going to be a democracy that supports the education of its citizens or not, and it doesn't matter the content delivery system. You've got to have excellence regardless of the choice.
So, Chris, on that particular point, what Greg said, so if we've seen failing traditional schools and failing charter schools, mm-hmm. we've seen successful traditional schools, successful charter schools, yes. Why don't we simply say, forget oppose failure across the board, and if something is successful, yes. right. I support but, that and continue it.
Yeah, that, because we've gotten into these boxes, these political boxes about whether I support vouchers. Look, at the end of the day, is my kid being educated? Take the model, throw it out. Let's see what's working. And that's not what we're doing. Instead, we're stuck in the same debate over and over again. I oppose this. No, I support that. No, you're a racist. No, you're not. And at the end of the day, our kids aren't learning. That's the issue. And
then, Spencer, hold for that 1 second. I want to get Spencer in.
Sorry.
Traditionally, when desegregation came, white folks fled, went to private schools, and largely defunded public schools, mm-hmm. right? So a question here is, right now, the Trump administration is shifting money, is basically talking about vouchers, shifting money possibly to private schools. That is a concern. That concerns me.
Well,
when we have so many black kids in public schools. So I'm not talking about charters. I'm not talking about
that. The Obama administration also got criticized
for
charter schools as well.
I'm not talking about charters. I'm talking about vouchers. I'm talking about giving public money to private schools.
But what I'm saying is, but even in this debate in terms of focus and shifting. Mm-hmm. Even they got criticized.
That's right.
So the issue is not even Trump or in terms of their budget. It's also when you've had this conversation, folks have criticized Democrats or Republicans. I want to get Randy's final comment. Then I want to get Steve's final comment.
So look, to your point.
Hold 1 second. You know what? Let me reverse it. I open with you. Steve, you're going to give your final comment first. Randy, give your final comment last. I'll reverse it. Go ahead, Steve.
It's important to understand that I support school choice, period. Not charter schools, not traditional schools, but any kind of school that works, because I believe that a parent knows better than anyone what's best for their child. And as Howard is a private institution, it does receive vouchers. It's called a Pell Grant, and that's a voucher, just like Medicaid, Medicare, and the like. And if we support school choice, we support access to quality education, and it's not about public or private. It's about what's best for our children. Brother, don't insult me.
I'm not. I wish you got to get that right.
So my union expelled our segregated locals and lost a lot of members because we said equity, justice is more important than anything else. That and what we are trying to do now is to your point, sir. If you see some good strategy, you use it. We run a charter school. I run a charter school in South Bronx that has 100% graduation rate. It is represented by the union. But it's a charter school. The public dollar has to go for a public purpose, first and foremost, to kids who are poor. And that's what we're fighting first and foremost, using better strategies to actually help kids succeed in a very complicated world. But we have to fight for that public dollar. And that is the biggest fight right now in terms of the Trump budget. To your point, Roland, yes, we had a fight with the Obama administration on certain things like test-based teacher accountability, which created too much testing. But on the issues of funding for schools, the Obama administration put the first dollar in always in terms of funding for schools, particularly in that last recession. That's a really different fight than right now, where about 15%, 13% of the federal education dollar is going bye-bye in this budget. That means
about $9 billion.
What?
By nine, well, for the folks at home. 13%. I want to give a number.
$11 billion. Okay. $11 billion. Every after school program goes bye bye. Every community school and wraparound service. All teacher training, all money for class size. That is how draconian, callous, and catastrophic it is.
Randy Weingarten, thanks a bunch. Steve Perry, correct, you're speaking next Monday at the National Charter Conference here in D.C. Is it Monday or Tuesday?
Monday, sir.
Okay, all right. Dr. Steve Perry, we appreciate it. Thanks a bunch.
All right, take it easy.
All right, folks, when we come back, we'll talk to the attorney of the unarmed black man who died at the hands of a cop in Las Vegas, now facing manslaughter charges for putting a martial arts-style chokehold on him. Also, the father of a 12-year-old middle school student in Texas says school officials need to do more to discipline the students who racially harassed her. Her dad's a civil rights attorney. They might not want to mess with him. Also, we'll talk to the governor of the U.S. Virgin Islands, who joins us right here on News 1 Now on TV 1, the only black governor in the United States and the surrounding territories. It is 20 before top of the hour. News 1 Now on TV 1.
So you want the truth. Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
Officer Lopera will be charged with involuntary manslaughter and oppression under the color of office.
Well, that was Nevada's Clark County Sheriff announcing criminal charges against a Las Vegas police officer following the release of a coroner's report concluding the death of an unarmed black man was homicide by asphyxiation. 31-year-old Officer Kenneth Lopera was released on $6,000 bail and pleaded not guilty to the charges. He's accused of using what is known as an unauthorized martial arts style chokehold on the victim, which blocks blood flow from the carotid artery to the brain. The autopsy also revealed that 40-year-old Tashi Farmer was high on methamphetamine and had an enlarged heart. He was the father of two who lived with his mother and was being treated for depression. Lopera's body camera captures the incident, which began at the Venetian Hotel coffee shop where Farmer approached the officer and his partner, telling them he was being followed. Lopera said he appeared sweaty and disoriented. A chase ensued. Once the officer caught up with him, he repeatedly shouted to Farmer to roll on his stomach and tased him 7 times, 4 times more than allowed by the department. The video shows Farmer reaching for his back, trying to remove the taser prongs. Hotel security cameras show police and Venetian security guards on the scene while Lopera punches Farmer in the face and neck. Lopera then puts Farmer in what is called the rear naked choke for a minute. After he was handcuffed, police noticed Farmer was not breathing and gave him CPR until paramedics arrived. He was pronounced dead at a hospital, of course. So let's go to our guest right now, folks. He is the attorney for Farmer, Andre Lagomarsino. Of Lagomarsino Law, who's representing the family of Tashi Brown. First and foremost, again, it's rare for us to actually talk about an officer being charged in the death of an unarmed black man.
That's right. This is the first time that the Clark County District Attorney's Office has ever charged a member of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department for acts committed while on duty. So it is quite a historic moment here in Las Vegas.
So he gets charged with manslaughter, but are you still fearful, though? We saw this happen in a case in Oklahoma City. We saw what happened with Michael Slager in South Carolina. And we can go on and on and on, where even with video, even with testimony, officer doesn't get convicted.
You know, the family, there's no amount of criminal prosecution that can bring Tashi Brown back. And so, yes, while the family wants justice, at least the police department and the district attorney's office has acknowledged that they believe it's criminal behavior, and it should be up to a Nevada jury to decide whether this officer is convicted or not.
And so what is now the police department, the first sheriff's office announced the charges against him. But what has been the response from them? Have they been in touch with the family? Have they apologized? What has been that relationship?
Well, there has been no apology from the police department. Internal Affairs has reached out to Tashi's mom to find out what was going on that night with him and to try to find out more information. But that's been the extent of it. She has been to the police department to pick up some of his belongings, but the police kept his cell phone, so they're going to be tracing back what he was doing that night, why he felt that he was in fear, why he felt that he was being chased by somebody. And there'll be what's known as a fact-finding review process here in a couple months in which the police department will present the evidence that they've shown to the public. It's different than the trial. But they do present quite a bit of evidence here. Nevada, we've had a long history of not only officer-involved deaths and in-custody deaths, but police-involved shootings. And as a result, the Justice Department came in here in 2012 and kind of implemented some training and some other procedures, including transparency, that hopefully will bring out some of the facts to light.
All right, then. Well, first of all, we certainly appreciate it. Thank you for joining us. We'll be following this case.
Thank you so much.
Let's go to Texas, folks, where the father of a 12-year-old African-American student who was subjected to racial harassment for several months by fellow schoolmates says the school did not do enough to punish the students whose conduct was investigated by officials. The incident took place at Tippett Middle School in Georgetown, Texas, just outside of Austin, Texas, where African-Americans comprise just 4% of the student body. Among other slurs, the student was called an ape and a slave by classmates, and at one point was chased by a female student with a piece of rubber who pretended to whip her, telling her, "You're my slave now." A report authored by the school's principal, Brian Dawson, details the racist comments and actions the victim endured, but said they did not amount to bullying because the victim was not physically threatened. The Georgetown Independent School District put out this statement, quote, "The behavior of the students involved in this incident was inappropriate and unacceptable. The campus principal responded swiftly, and all students involved were appropriately disciplined according to our student code of conduct." According to the victim's father, his daughter will attend a different school next year. Let's talk to him right now. Robert Ranko, civil rights attorney at the Carlson Law Firm and the father of the student who was racially harassed. Here you are, civil rights attorney. You hear this response from the school district. I take it you're not satisfied.
No, sir. They say that the students were appropriately disciplined within their code of conduct. I would disagree that that's true. If that's true, then we need to review the code of conduct, because what they define as bullying and the manner in which they would punish students who would do this to anybody, not just my daughter, but anybody, it's unacceptable, and they're not addressing it appropriately.
And so how long is your daughter going to this school?
She's been there about 4 years.
She's been there 4 years. What grade is she in?
In the school district. This is the middle school. So she just finished seventh grade.
For seventh grade. And so obviously she's been going there. She has friends there. And you decided you're going to move her out of the school. I mean, you know, that is a disruption. It's unnecessary. And so surely you're not happy about that.
Well, we're not happy about any disruption. This is not the first incident that she's dealt with. There were three incidents this spring involving my younger daughter. My older daughter went to the school previously. We had issues with the administration then as to how they would deal with incidents involving her, discipline of other students. They tried to suspend my older daughter when she showed up to school with a red braid and tried to suspend her for a week for something that wasn't even a policy. It took pain in the neck lawyer dad to review the policy and tell the principal that he couldn't suspend somebody for something that's not a rule.
What's next?
Next is we're trying to deal within the system that the school has within the independent school district. This, what I have come to learn, we are not unique. There's been a pattern of failures when it comes to disciplining students who bully kids, who do racist things against children of color. And it needs to stop. You know, I thought my kid was, they were failing to validate what happened to her when they failed to punish these kids really at all, other than some counseling and a few wind sprints at tennis practice. What I found out is I was the lucky one because I got a report done. I start talking to other people in the community and I find out they can't even get reports done when their kids are beat up, when their kids are racially harassed. So the system they have in place is failing across the board. My kid was just the next kid in line that it happened to.
All right, then. Robert Ranko, we appreciate it. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, folks, coming up next, we'll talk with Governor Kenneth Mapp of the U.S. Virgin Islands about what's taking place there when it comes to Medicaid, minimum wage, and other issues. 10 before top of the hour, News 1 Now on TV 1.
Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
The U.S. Virgin Islands turned 100 this year. The islands of St. Croix, St. Thomas, and St. John were purchased by the United States from Denmark in 1917. Under the leadership of the only Black governor in the United States, the U.S. Virgin Islands recently expanded its Medicaid program. The territory has one of the highest minimum wages in America. Joining us right now is Governor Kenneth Mapp of the U.S. Virgin Islands. How's it going?
Fine, Roland. Good morning. How are you?
Doing great. So for the folks out there, you're governor of the U.S. Virgin Islands, but you're not a state.
We're not. We're a territory, an incorporated territory. There are five of us, Puerto Rico, Guam, American Samoa, and the Northern Marianas Islands.
So you want to be a state?
I don't know if that's a debate going on in the Virgin Islands. It's more robust in Puerto Rico. I would say the people of the Virgin Islands are pretty much at status quo towards more integration with the United States. But there are a lot of economic issues being a state and not being a state in terms of customs and trade and the economy. So I don't know that we have a robust debate about becoming a state.
So you have a member of Congress, though, but she doesn't vote.
That's correct. And nor do the people in the Virgin Islands vote for the president of the United States. We're subject to the call of the president for conflicts, and we hold the highest distinction of the largest sacrifices per capita in all of the conflicts of the U.S. We have a robust enrollment of Virgin Islanders in the armed forces, and our cemeteries have honored veteran sections, and we just have a large number of people that have died on sacrifices in the conflict of the country, but we cannot exercise our vote for president living in the territories. We can exercise them if we move to the mainland and take up residency, and there are 40,000 people who affiliate as Virgin Islanders that live in the U.S. mainland and have the right to exercise their vote for president.
Now, we're seeing, of course, with this whole fight battle when it comes to minimum wage. How are you able to actually get that done when you still have cities here who are fighting it? You have legislatures who are passing laws preventing cities like North Carolina from passing their own minimum wage ordinances.
Well, I have to say I have a very robust and forward-thinking legislature of the Virgin Islands. And 3 years ago, they appropriately, and I was very happy to sign into law legislation advancing the minimum wage from $7.15. Next year it will end up, I believe, at $10.50. It went to $9.50 this year. The Virgin Islands has it's a high cost place to live. In point of fact, it is higher than living in Washington, D.C. That's correct.
That's high.
When federal employees are assigned to the U.S. Virgin Islands, they enjoy a 34% increase in pay, a COLA, because of their cost of living in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And so it was important.
Why is that?
It has to do with the importation of goods. It has to do with, you live in an insular area. You're 1,200 miles outside of Florida. It's just a little bit more expensive to live there. And, of course, it's a high tourist destination.
Greg Carr?
You know, the question of minimum wage is always a question of, will it hurt the economy? I got one of my best friends, Kathy Adams, teaches at the HBCU, of course, Virgin Islands.
Yes.
And she talks about that cost of living. How does raising the minimum wage affect the economy? What can you deal with that? Because the naysayers say
Well, it does, but there are several things that's very good about the Virgin Islands in terms of economic growth and supporting a minimum wage. One, we're a high tourist destination, so you have a lot of spending. We do financial services. We give very excellent tax incentives. We can give you up to 90% abatement on your federal tax obligation for doing business and housing business in the Virgin Islands.
Wow.
We're developing our workforce and the quality and the work skill of our people. And it's just very important. You can't have people living on the margins where they can't feed families, where seniors have to make choices about medicines or electricity. Mm-hmm. That just doesn't work. And when you have folks that can come in the Virgin Islands and pay up to $25,000 a night for a villa, or $500 on average for a hotel room,
yes,
and you're housing 3 million American visitors, and we're happy to have them, you've got to really work in terms of bringing the margins of the quality of life of workers in the territory up.
Why should African Americans on the mainland care about the Virgin Islands, and what do you want them to know and do, basically, in terms of supporting the Virgin Islands?
African Americans on the mainland should care about the Virgin Islands because most African Americans' ancestors who live on the mainland came through the Caribbean in the slave trade. Just be frank about that you had to be broken in the Caribbean before you came up to Mississippi and to Louisiana and all the states to just be on the plantation. And we are very much connected. Mm-hmm. And if you have an insular area, an American community with the majority of African Americans, you want to be sure that the U.S. government, which is responsible for its insular areas, the 4 million people that live in the territories, are doing the right thing, that there are opportunities, that there are economic growth, that we're taking care of our seniors and our children. If it's not happening in a small community, trust me, it will not happen in a large community.
I got about 45 seconds left. Chris, quick question.
Just quick question.
Can a brother get an application?
You can come and visiting the Virgin Islands, you don't need a passport. You can fly directly from Washington, from Dulles, from Atlanta, from the East Coast, from Houston, Texas, land in St. Thomas, land in St. Croix. Have a wonderful time. Meet all of our virgins that live in the Virgin Islands. And
did you
bring plenty of money when you come?
It's
a family show, man.
Well, Chris Singles, so he's like, I'm good to go.
We want you to come on down. I mean, it's just an exciting place to be. We're at a crossroad where our economy is growing. We're creating more opportunity for our people and want them to get in business. St. Croix is driving a culinary industry with our young black males who are chefs, been successful on the mainland, coming home and opening business. It's just a good time to be in the Virgin Islands.
Well, y'all got to invite me to speak at the HBCU.
And you've been in the Virgin Islands.
I've been there many times.
I'm told you're a member of Alpha Phi Alpha.
So is Greg.
Yes, sir.
So
one of my senators said I should tell you hello, Senator Sanders.
There you go.
Yes.
What up, 06? I got to go to a break. Back in 60 seconds.
Wherever you are, we are. Your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Betty Wap turns 26. Allen Iverson turns 42. Y'all got a movie. Come on now. L.A. Reid turns 61. And Nikki Giovanni turns 74. Tomorrow on News One Now, we'll talk about Jim Comey testifying before Congress. Ooh, it's going to be a little hot. I got to go. Holla!
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.